This week, the Western mystery tradition is often said to be a leading influence on many members of the craft today. But what good is a tradition if it has no continuity? This week, we'll get honest about it and explore what is considered its greatest influencer, the medieval grimoires. Join us with special guest Brother Patrick Day of the Rocky Mountain Mason for an unapologetic and real discussion about magic. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, now we're back. This is episode number 443. Just want to say a quick thanks and a shout out to all of our Patreon subscribers and PayPal subscribers, those of you who keep this show going month after month, especially in this time, global pandemic. And as we have said, during this time, we're not doing any advertisements. Times are tough. But I did want to say, if you would like to be a producer, a fellow, or a contributor of the WCY Podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and check out all the details. Click on Support the Show. Now let's get into this awesome interview with Brother Patrick Day. All right, everybody, we are back this week, and I am thrilled. We've been talking about having Brother Patrick Day back on the show for quite a while now, worshipful brother, I should say. And so we had Brother Patrick Day on back in episode number 406. And so it's been almost 50 episodes since the last time he was on. And so I just want to say welcome back to the program, Brother Patrick.
Oh, thanks. Thank you for having me back on. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, for sure. You know, after our last conversation, we talked a little bit about having you come back on to really talk about esoteric stuff, philosophy, and these kind of things. It's always a hot topic. I get emails all the time that come to the show, and people will always say, I love the esoteric, the more the better. And so I always try to put a little something symbolic inside of these episodes, but when we can devote an entire episode to a topic like this and have these kinds of conversations, it's always better. So just really excited to have you on. One of the main things that I find really intriguing is we've been going back and forth, and to the listeners out there, Brother Patrick Day has a really interesting background. He's a super smart guy, and I don't want you to retort and say, oh, I'm just some guy. He's absolutely brilliant. You got to check out his work that's been put in the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine. I think we actually talked about your piece just a few weeks ago.
Which one?
The one where you talked about, like, the esoteric Mason.
Oh, yeah, the love-hate relationship people have with esoteric masonry.
Yes, that was a brilliant piece. Absolutely loved it. It was on point for sure. I got to ask, just in brief, how was the response to that article after it went out?
I'm actually not totally sure. Not a lot of people have reached out to me about it. One guy thought it was just super great. Like, he texted me, like, probably a week after it was mailed out, and he said it was great. But I think he just thought it was, like, a defense of the esoteric masonry. And I was like, well, I do have some complaints about esoteric masonry and that.
Yep.
And then another guy actually thought it was still too esoteric for him, and I just was like, maybe he missed the point. I don't know. So.
Well, yeah, so let's talk a little bit about some of this critique, right? Like, most of our listeners who do have the esoteric bone in their body are well aware of why folks are not super into the esoteric at times. And I think you did a great job of going through those points. That was basically, A, we assume people know things that they probably don't know. We often come off like, I don't know, is there a nice way to say jerks? We come off acting like...
Kind of pompous. I mean,
yeah.
I guess that happens, like, that seems to be natural. You see it with academics, too, that when they're really fluent and know a lot about a particular subject, and particularly one that could be obscure or difficult to understand, and they try and explain it around other people, and it doesn't even have to be esoteric stuff. It could be, like, I don't know, the history of the Russian economy in the Middle Ages. And it just, if they were to try and discuss it, it just go over people's heads. And you could see how they'd get frustrated with that. It's like, I know what I'm talking about, and it's just going over everybody's heads. And you can see how they tend to get isolated in that regard, because it is frustrating to spend so much time researching, trying to understand something as complex and as studious and as meditative as esoteric subjects in masonry can be, and then for people to just go, I don't get it, that's too esoteric for me. And just, you get a sense of why they tend to feel isolated and think, like, well, these people just don't know anything, do they?
Right, yeah.
So it was just me trying to understand where are they coming from with this and why.
And I think you did a great job in the way you approached it. The other side of your argument was exactly this idea that, of course, the esoteric Mason could also be a little bit more polite, could probably practice something called justice in terms of equality, right? Like bring somebody up to your level. If they don't know, teach them and how to be nice about that kind of thing. But then the converse, the flip side of the coin was also, you had some great points in there too about brothers being tolerant of new ideas and willing to learn. And I think that's a fundamental idea for many of the esoteric brothers that I know. I probably know a good handful that are not this way also, but I would say on occasion I'll meet an esoteric brother who won't at all converse with anybody who is a brother on any topic, or really just kind of think that person's an idiot or whatever, when most Masons, I think, are of the mind that they still know that they can learn something from somebody that's Masonic that isn't esoteric and still appreciate it. On the other side, though, there seems to be this idea that maybe if somebody's an esoteric Mason, you shouldn't even talk to them and you should just steer clear or whatever. Have you experienced?
Yeah, that's unfortunate. The thing is that Freemasonry has long been wrapped up in the symbolic and even the occult to some regards. There's plenty of occultists throughout history who have wanted to be Freemasons. Ebenezer Sibley was one. He was a big collector of grimoires, and he was pretty big into astrology. But, you know, guys like, even as recently as the 19th and 20th centuries, you know, we had MacGregor Mathers, we had Aleister Crowley, we had A.E. Waite, guys like that, Rudolf Steiner, you know, they were all Masons, and they were also super into esoteric and occult stuff. And it's obviously those guys were attracted to Masonry because of its esoteric and occult value. So that means that obviously somewhere in Masonry, there are esoteric and occult things to it. It's not just history and morality. That morality gets wrapped up in symbols. And some of those symbols, you have to follow a very long tradition of some deeply esoteric topics and studies and traditions to really start to understand. And it's one of those things that I say, the historical will inform the spiritual, and the spiritual will inform the historical. Some guys just want to get into the historical, and I find sometimes it's hard to get through the historical unless you have an understanding of the frame of mind of some of these guys, and what they were working with, and what they were approaching, and why Masonry was of value to them, that they sought it out for those purposes. So even people who just want to see it for a historical social club, I think they're missing a big part of it.
It's funny, you alluded to the idea that there are many parts to Masonry. I was just covering for an episode that's coming out on the 26th. There was an article that was written that disclosed a survey of some 2,800 Masons in the 1953, in like August of 1953 or somewhere around there. They polled different Masons about their interest in quote-unquote Masonic education. What should Masonic education cover? And of course, there were I don't think they gave them like fixed responses. What they did was they took the responses they got and kind of categorized them as best they could and threw a percentage on there. And the report came out about a year later, and it said that about 39% response requested information on history, I think history is great. It's a wonderful, tangible thing to wrap your head around. But it also, as you pointed out, it informs the spiritual to an extent. But then some of the other responses, you know, we talk about parts. When I ran a survey and said, what's your favorite part about Lodge? You know, what should we be doing? And I gave four choices, and I said rank them or whatever. It came out, you know, like social, charity, ritual, education. They were like 25% across the board, just about. Guys really kind of do want a well-rounded experience. But when it came to the niche subject of education in this 1954 thing, it had history, where we came from, and then it got to like 2.1% or something like that, and it was symbolism with 2%. And believe it or not, Patrick, believe it or not, Patrick, this was the best. 1.17% postage stamps.
Oh, yeah, that was totally a thing. I'm Research Lodge of Colorado. We just published the first volume of our past papers. You can find it on Lulu. But I'm going through the next set of papers to do volume two, and one of them was on Masonic postage stamps. That was such a big thing.
I'm like, what? I think
and I immediately thought when I was reading through that paper, I was, wow, Americans have a really weird history. We went from hating postage stamps to starting collections of postage stamps and even niche collections of postage stamps to today where we're like, what's a postage stamp?
Right. And then I was just dumbfounded. And then further on in the report, I mean, the paper was written in the 70s referring to something in the 50s. And in the 1970s, they had this preoccupation with hating chain letters, Masonic chain letters. Alphonse Cerza is rallying against chain letters. What are these problems? Is this guy, when Masons get into Masonic chat rooms on Facebook and request that you play, you know, Farmville? Is this the equivalent?
Maybe.
It's so bizarre.
Going through some of these Research Lodge papers, I can't believe how many of them bring up how Masonry can be used to fight communism. I mean, admittedly, it was the Cold War, but
sure.
It was still like, wow, it was amazing how many papers were related to Masons hate communism.
Right.
Wow, these don't seem relevant today.
So bizarre. Let's dive into this topic a little bit. The whole idea, and we talked in the green room a little bit about some Masonic buzzwords, words that I think are probably used. Some are used too much. Some are used a lot. Not that it's super annoying. It's just, oh, there's that word again. It's a buzzword. This year in business, all the quarterly reports, everybody was using the term headwinds. We encountered headwinds, but, you know, we still made it to the destination kind of thing, you know, referring to troubles ahead. But in Masonry, we have buzzwords, too. One, a few years ago, everybody was all over, right, through the TO lodges, right, the term egregore, just say collective consciousness or whatever, right? Or terms like...
It's weird that egregore has taken on such a strange evolution of that term. The first time I even heard the term egregore being used in like modern occultism, I was like, wait, are you talking about the Watchers from the Book of Genesis? They're like, no, these are psychological entities, and I'm like, oh my god, we're on completely different pages. I don't know where that one came from.
Right. Spiritual archetypalism or something. It's so weird. And then you've got another one is the Western esoteric traditions or Western mystery schools or things that use this Western tradition, whatever, you know, insert your other thing in there.
Yeah, I got a lot of problems with that phrase.
Yeah, we should.
The problem, I think, with that phrase is that it's trying to assert that there is a continuous tradition when, in fact, historically we know there is no continuous esoteric or mystery tradition or occult tradition or even magical tradition. There's not a continuous one. It's constantly been broken up. What we have in the Western occult tradition is effectively a broken tradition. And I mean, this goes all the way back to like ancient Egypt. You'll see it historically that it's okay for the high priests and the kings and such high-ranking persons as them to be able to use things like magic and divination. You'll see it in, like, the Book of Genesis and even in Exodus, and you'll see it on up through, like, the books of Samuel and Kings, that, you know, you'll see the high priest, you'll find references to the Urim and the Thurim. These were divination devices. We don't know exactly what they are, but we know there was some form of claromancy, the equivalent of, like, casting lots to divine the will of God. But you see it in, I believe it's in 2 Samuel, you have the Witch of Endor, and it refers to Saul. God has refused to answer any of Saul's questions via dream interpretation. That's long been a form of magic and divination. God wouldn't send him an answer via the Thurim and Urim. There was no way he could get God to answer him, so he goes to a sorcerer. In this case, it was not okay for him to do that because he lost the battle the next day. God was very mad at him for doing that. But we do see that there was this long tradition of it's okay for the king and the priest to do magic and divination, but not okay for the common people. And that's why we see it as a Levitical law, that the divination and witchcraft are strictly forbidden under penalty of death. And see that in ancient Egypt. You'll see that in Rome. The reason why in the Roman Empire magic and whatnot were looked down upon was because it could be a threat to the emperor. That someone could use magic to, I don't know, curse or send a disease upon the emperor and kill him. We see this again with the church. The church has the right to perform exorcisms. Driving out demons was a common magical practice. We find examples of it in the Greek magical papyri. The church can offer salvation. The church can heal. And there's all kinds of these sorts of magical practices that it's okay for the hierarchical people to use, but the lower people, not so much. You're not right. allowed to. And so we see this repeated process of stamping out magical and occult traditions. You see it all the time. It constantly gets stamped out, and then a few hundred years later, it gets kind of recreated. They seem to pick up the pieces and try to recreate it, and it isn't until the Middle Ages that we really seem to have what could effectively be continuous tradition, largely with the grimoires. They're starting from a broken tradition, but as it moved on through the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, that it stayed a continuous tradition. It wasn't constantly being destroyed. And then they'd have to pick up the pieces again later. So there is no actual Western occult tradition or Western mystery tradition.
Yeah, it's a tradition. It's a tradition because we're so wrapped up. And I don't know why we have, I think I know why. It's just a psychological need to have origin, because the older it is, the more true it must be.
Mm-hmm.
But like this idea that lineage, right? For instance, anybody who was involved with, say, you know, the follow the string, right? So from Rosicrucianism into Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, to Alpha and Omega, Theosophy, whatever, you know, everybody's got to trace it to something. And then you have like this basic hearsay that something exists and people just accept to fill the gap. It's really weird.
They always try to do that. You know, a great example I come across is how much it seems Masons will find out about the Roman Collegia and then try to trace, at the very least, our origin back to the Collegia, which were essentially colleges. There were groups of people who bound together by a common trait or a common goal. So, I mean, if you had a group of three people who, I don't know, let's say you had three girls who herd goats through the public square, they could call themselves a college. There were examples of colleges that were actually authorized by the emperor, things like the Bakers. But where the colleges leave off is actually in a very terrible state. They were pretty much under tyrannical rule by the emperor. They were pretty much in a form of slavery. And they pretty much fell apart by the 4th century. And when you get to the 10th century, there were some towns that tried to revive some idea of the college, but they tried to bring it back where it left off, and it fell apart really quickly. And then that's when the idea of the guilds comes along. So there's this big gap in there of about, oh, maybe 500, 600 years. And we even see historically by experiment that they couldn't revive the colleges. Somehow, I find it in papers and I'll see it in books where they'll try and link the colleges to the guilds and therefore up to our modern day speculative masonry. It's like, no. Historically, you don't even want there to be a continuation there because
yeah.
It was really terrible where the colleges left off.
Yeah, you find this weird kind of connection. You know, the way I think about it is guild system, a place to discuss interesting things, free from ridicule, free from prison, free from a death sentence through the Renaissance and then into the Enlightenment period. And then you kind of have this upper echelon. I want to say it feels like Victorian, well-to-do, in vogue spiritualism that just wants to tie everything back to this stuff.
It was a romanticism in a way of here's an old tradition here that we know historically goes back. Some of the first guilds were popping up in the 11th century, and effectively all a guild was a government-sanctioned monopoly on a specific trade. So essentially, like, the governor, the king, or the lord would say, yes, you are the only fisherman, or you're the only ones permitted to bake bread and sell it. And the first historically recorded charters of stonemason guilds is early 12th century. But they had a long tradition going on there. I mean, when you look at that, you know, 1100s up to, you know, the 1600s, there's 500 years of a continuous tradition. It's almost as if the aristocrats, effectively what they were patrons. All guilds had patrons who were aristocrats, usually someone involved in that trade. Like, for instance, a goldsmith guild, you might have a patron, and this is a guy who owns a gold mine. So it is in his interest to be part of the goldsmith guild. And effectively what the patron would do is argue upon the guild's behalf to, say, the governor, the council, or the king, or whatever, and help make or change legislation for them, maybe drop levies or change some rules for them. But by the time you get to the Enlightenment period, it seems to be like you had a lot of aristocrats who were very interested in old continuous traditions that were not open to everybody else. And that's probably where this interest in wanting to join a guild, become a patron of a guild, and thus is born speculative masonry. So it does seem to be born out of this spiritual idea of these guys know something, we don't. These guys are holding on to these old secrets and traditions they keep to themselves because they have a monopoly on it. And we kind of want in on that. And this is born the speculative masonry.
Right. So earlier you mentioned the term grimoire, right? So I'm somewhat familiar with grimoires, but I think if you had asked me about grimoires, oh, just 5, 6 years ago, and maybe to some of our people listening, when they hear the word grimoire, they probably just think about something like Hansel and Gretel. So let's talk a little bit about when you say the word grimoire in this context, what are we talking about, Patrick?
We're talking about books of magic. That's effectively all a grimoire is it's a handbook on magic. It's not like if you look at the works of Eliphas Levi, he writes a lot about magic, but he doesn't really tell you how to do anything. So that's not really a grimoire. It's more of a handbook. What do you do? What are the things you need? How do you need to go about making these? And timing, and what are you trying to address? What are you trying to do magic-wise? And most grimoires, at least those going back to the Middle Ages and even long before that, things like the Greek Magic Papyri, they're concerned with spirits because, you know, today we think of magic as like, I focus my intentions and it'll manifest in the universe. That's something that was kind of like, I think the Theosophists were some of the first ones coming up with that. They were trying to understand what were the mechanics behind magic. And they thought the meditative aspects behind magic were the true mechanics. And they thought they could just isolate the meditative part, and it would work. But I doubt that's really the case. You know, most practitioners I've come across who work with the grimoires are like, no, you're working with spirits. You're conjuring or evoking angels or terrestrial spirits or deceased spirits or demons or even deities, and that these are what makes magic happen. And so when you look at these old grimoires, they are largely focused on spirit magic. Some of them include things like making amulets and phylacteries and charms and stuff like that, but they're still centered around the idea that spirits and angels and demons make these things possible. It's not just you and your will. It is there is an outside force that's working on your behalf. That's how a lot of these grimoires are structured. It isn't until about the late 18th, maybe early 19th century that you start to get this idea that, oh, we just focus our intentions. Prior to that, it was all spirits.
And so what we'll say, ideas, for instance, even in Freemasonry, a very common, I guess, idea would be, say, the Book of Solomon, the idea of Solomon's seal, where he supposedly controlled demons or spirits or the jinn or something to, with his magic signet ring, that is this idea, right? And then when you talked about the idea of theosophy and kind of it's loose, but I'll say New Age concept of the secret, right, is born out of they're both really born out of that spiritualism idea. It's like the jump, because it goes from spirit to almost a Hindu-type concept of gods representing psychological attributes, perhaps, but then refined even more, goes into that New Age thing where it's like, well, those are psychological attributes that you have to attach to emotionally in order to functionally use the mentalism of, you know, manifesting something you want. When you talk about the grimoires in specific, so you said this is like a spell book, the Arbitel maybe, or Abramelin.
It's a bit inappropriate to like call them a spell book, because it just kind of conjures up like the idea of what we think of when we see a movie or a TV show where it's, I'm gonna do a money spell and I'll just flip open this book and chant these words and light a candle and that's all I need to do. Where when you look at the older grimoires from like the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, it really is, sometimes those are in there, but usually you're already working with a spirit. You've already contacted like a familiar or some sort of tutelary spirit that you can rely on, and they will then teach you. A little bit different in, say, like the Goetia of the Lamegaton, where they actually like have a catalog of spirits when you can kind of look through them and go, oh, this one's really good at teaching me, I don't know, the seven liberal arts and sciences, because you could call upon a spirit to teach you the seven liberal arts. Or this one is really good at bringing money, and this one is really good at bringing me, helping me find buried treasure. That was a big one. Buried treasure was a big one in the grimoires. And you could then conduct your ceremonial rite to call forth that spirit and get them to help you. So you got to understand about the people in the Renaissance and the Middle Ages that spirits and angels were not considered like concepts of the mind. They were not psychological. They were considered to be very, very real.
Right.
And especially in the Middle Ages, they thought they were just a threat. I mean, even in the, you know, Jesus' time, when you read through the Gospels, I mean, good God, half the things that Jesus is doing is dealing with casting away spirits and banishing demons. And it's like half his job. So obviously even then they thought it was a big problem then.
Let me ask this, though. So when you talked about these things, if we move through history with these grimoires, and we get to a point where we say, okay, when you talk about occultism and it's the grimoires, when do the grimoires become something that is kind of lost into common knowledge? When do we see, because, you know, right around, say, the early part of the 20th century, we have the advent of spiritualism as a full-blown religion, which, you know, it has kind of those two camps, right? There's, and it's funny that I use the word camps, right, because it's campy. But there's one section of spiritualism that's very much involved with the with some serious things, and then there's another section that's like, you know, fortune tellers and spirit readers and palm readers and that kind of thing. And of course, within that second camp, the latter camp, there's a lot of room for, you know, charlatans and people who are just out there taking folks' money. So with that idea of like spiritualism, right, you would think, because they're all about working with spirits, do we see things like grimoires being used in spiritualism in the early 20th? Or where do we see that? Where does that happen? Where does it go?
I think it's largely the theosophists who were trying to dismiss it, these grimoires. I'm not sure Blavatsky and Alice Bailey and those folks had a problem with them. Not totally familiar with their line of work, but, you know, I will say guys like A.E. Waite, he hated the grimoires. If you ever come across his book, like True Black Magic, sometimes it's just called Ceremonial Magic, it depends. If you ever actually open up that book and look in it, he's taking excerpts from a lot of different grimoires, like Key of Solomon, the Lamegaton, the Abermelin. Actually, I don't think the Abermelin's in that one. He does pull from the Heptameron, and he's pulling the weirdest things from them. He's pulling, like, the strangest excerpts he possibly can pull from them to make the grimoires look ridiculous. He's trying to dismiss them by making them look stupid.
A.E. Waite excelled at making people look stupid. That's like his whole shtick.
Oh, yeah. But there was one grimoire he liked, and that was the Arvatel, which you mentioned earlier, probably because it's like the most, in appearance, it's the most pared down. It's largely a philosophy of Christian magic.
Yeah, based on Olympiad, based on Greek, almost Greek god concepts.
Yeah, they use the Olympian spirits, which is in that one, the seven Olympian spirits. But he seems to have high regards for the Arvatel, because the Arvatel is like, you know, you shouldn't worship these spirits. Don't worship these icons. Be a good Catholic. Go to Mass, you know, say your daily prayers and stuff like that. You know, use magic to help your neighbor and things like that. So you can tell he has a high regard for the Arvatel. But all the other grimoires he's pulling excerpts from, he's trying to make them look as stupid as possible. And I think that was in line with a lot of theosophists. And I think even the spiritualists, they're either ignorant of a lot of the old grimoires, or it was possible that the old medieval grimoires were a threat to what they were working on. They didn't want to call upon actual spirits and angels and demons. They wanted to call upon people who once lived. That was largely what spiritualism was focused on, was calling upon people who once lived. And you are right, it practically was a religion unto itself. I think I just want to jump back real quick on, you know, I've been talking about the Western mystery and the Western esoteric tradition, that it's a broken one. If you want to see the opposite of that, you look to the East. And in Asia, their occult traditions are not broken. They're pretty much continuous. They've developed and evolved over the years, but it's never really had this issue with, we have to stomp this out. So when you look at feng shui, and I mean like classical feng shui, not like just moving...
Not moving my
furniture
around. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's not this new agey version of feng shui where it's like, move the furniture and paint the walls different colors. It really was like, it also involves spirits, usually spirits of directions, but also spirits of planets. So it's like, you know, this part of my house, you know, it has a very martial energy because it's facing, I think it's the southwest, and it's not in a good aspect. So I need to help offset the negative aspects of that. And so I'll set up an altar, probably water-based, you know, maybe a little bowl and some flowers, but specific flowers for specific spirits to help harmonize that area.
Why do you think the Eastern tradition didn't get broken? Your best theory.
Probably because the kings and the religious groups of the East didn't feel threatened by magic. Like, they didn't see it as a threat.
Do you think though that they didn't feel it was a threat because there seems to be a thread of honor, of integrity, of duty that fills the East in a way that's a little bit different? It's Star Trek fans immediately just think Vulcan, right? It's always duty based, so maybe there's not the threat, or is it that there's a practical side of strong will and might in terms of the military and the way things work? Do you think any of that had a reason to say why a king or somebody wouldn't be afraid of magic? Or do you think that the magic in itself was more always centered around more altruistic values?
I couldn't tell you. A lot of magic in the East is usually centered on community good, doing this to serve your family, to serve your community. Some regards, I mean, obviously it can be used for bad, but I honestly couldn't tell you why.
So do you think just maybe balance? Because you mentioned it earlier in sort of the practical nature of even just designing a house or whatever. You talked about negative and adding positive attributes. Perhaps the key is just in balance.
Right. A lot of feng shui is trying to find a balance, find a harmony. There are certain things we would call a spell, praying to certain deities or spirits and calling upon them. You know, for instance, casinos in the East, you know, the way they're set up, they'd use feng shui to try and funnel money in but not let the money flow back out. And that relies on a long tradition of spirits and altars and colors and, you know, different flowers and things like that and how you set them up. And we'll talk about like the energy or the charge, but also it's related to the spirits of the place. And in the West, we have ideas of spirit of place and a lot of different types of spirits of place. But in the East, it seems to be, at least in their occult tradition, is that it seems to be more central to part of the old culture that still lives today, still lives on through today. I'm not as familiar with the East, so I can't speak as intensively as I could about the West, but these are just some of the generalities I understand that I could speak on.
Look, I have to tell people all the time, I'll get a question or something after a presentation, and I have to say, that's a great question. I wish I had an answer. But we find ourselves in these places every so often when we have these kinds of conversations. So I want to go back to the idea on some of the grimoires in terms of, you know, we'll go back to the Western magical tradition, if you will. Do we see an influence in the grimoires or their work or what they contain within Freemasonry?
In some ways, yeah. There is one of the old charges is called the, commonly called the Grand Manuscript. I'm trying to remember its MSS number. But in the Grand Manuscript, it's written like a catechism. So it's not like ritual. But it has the Masonic Catechism in it. One of the parts of it, it brings up essentially the equivalent of what do you use masonry for? And it says the candidate's given a question, and one of the things he responds with, he writes that the secret titles and primitive tallies of the Godhead was preservative, and he builded on them in so much that no infernal squandering spirit durst presume to shake his handiwork, so his work became so famous. And there's another part in this as well where it mentions the infernal squandering spirits. But it's curious, even in some of the old Masonic documents that bring up that how masonry and the work of masonry should be done so that it's unaffected by infernal spirits. That might be one aspect, because when we look at the old grimoires, it's definitely important that the magician, undergoes purification rituals. They'll oftentimes undergo periods of chastity, fasting. They do regular ritual bathing and don clean clothes and things like that. It's a means of essentially illustrating to the spirit you're going to call upon that, you know, I am worthy. You must listen to me. Look at me. I haven't indulged in any carnal intercourse in months, and I have been fasting for even longer, and I am clean, and I am wearing holy oil, and look at these garments I'm wearing. Don't these look like kingly garments? You must listen to me then. Then the whole idea is that you're presenting a sort of authority that the spirits want to listen to. And in a way, doesn't masonry also teach us both teach us mental purity to better ourselves, to
100%
level of perfection that the magician is trying to present himself as to command the spirits? But even in some regards, you know, I think even some magical tradition made their way into certain Masonic authors and some of their work. I'm currently going through Henry P.H. Bromwell's his Ancient Free and Accepted Architects Ritual, and which was published by the Grand College of Rites. What is it? I think it's Volume 4. And at one point he, I think it's in the Most Excellent Architect in that degree. It brings up King Solomon and his signet with the Pent Alpha on it, or the Seal of Solomon.
Yeah.
The Pent Alpha is essentially, just for our listeners, that it's five A's arranged in the shape of a pentagram, pretty much. And that was on his ring, according to the Testament of Solomon. The Archangel Michael gave to Solomon a ring with the Pent Alpha on it, and he used that to command and coerce the spirits. And he either sealed them away, or he'd make them work on a temple. And so, I mean, even Bromwell thought that had a place in Masonic ritual and writes it into his own Masonic rite that it kind of died out a couple of decades later. But nonetheless, even he thought that had a place in Masonry, the Seal of Solomon.
Absolutely. You know, when I think about this and I think about how these kind of grimoire ideas, or at least kind of the shadow concepts, perhaps not the actual practices, right, like do this, do this, do this, but the legend of such things are definitely within the Masonic ritual and allude to the same outcomes through the practice of what Masonry's ritual teaches.
Sure.
It's fascinating.
I think, you know, in another regard, you know, you also got to consider how many of these other magical orders have been created in the image of Freemasonry. You know, the Order Templi Orientis, that was started off as a Masonic order, a German Masonic order, and then Crowley got involved and took it over and transformed it into his own little cult that, but you know, they still go on today, and if you ever look into the practices of the OTO, it's very much still got a lot of Masonic elements to it. And same thing with the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
Yep.
They also carry a lot of Masonic overtones in it because it grew out of it. And both of those are magical orders today.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's born out of them is, if you read the writings of some of the gents who started, like, say, the first organized Rosicrucian order, what you find is they're tied to the people, of course, who created the first Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And their notes essentially say, we want a way to practice magic in a practical, real way. We're not just here reading and studying about it. We want to do it. And then you see these offshoots of Hermetic Order, Alpha et Omega. Then you've got, of course, OTO. And then there's a spinoff, AA, and some other things. But, yeah, Masonry seems to be the seedling.
Stuff like that, you know, I've come across occultists who are Freemasons, and they'll say, I didn't join OTO, I didn't join Golden Dawn, I think Freemasonry was sufficient. And admittedly, like, when you look at practices of a lot of magic from, if it's the Grimoires or even modern day things, you know, they involve things like ritual. You know, you should be getting yourself into a headspace. You know, you're probably going to have to do some sort of floor work, lighting of candles, setting up altars, presenting yourself in a dignified manner, and working on your own conscience to become a better, stronger person. But also things like memorization is also a big part of it.
Why do you think memorization is a big part of it?
Well, at least when it comes to spirit magic, a lot of practitioners of old grimoires that do spirit magic is they'll tell you, you know, the spirits aren't going to take you seriously if they just see you reading from a book. And then also, what if something goes wrong? And you know, you're just going to go flipping through a book to go figure out what you now need to do? You know, it helps.
Hold on a second here. So you mean it's not cool to be like the movie Monster Squad at the end, where she's flipping through the book to try to find... She's trying to find the right spell?
Yeah, and, well, it's not just... Yeah, no, exactly. It's, you know, in some regards, there are instances where it's believed certain things where it's just the words that have the power to themselves. For instance, like psalm magic. It's the psalms themselves that hold the power. And it's not uncommon in a lot of occult practices to find that sacred scripture holds a power unto itself. I'm trying to remember what they're called, but a lot of Orthodox Jews, they'll wear a phylactery, and it's like, there's a little leather black box that they strap to their head. And what's in that black box is pieces of written scripture. And it's that the scripture itself has its own power. And same thing with the Psalms, you know, in voodoo and even a bit in some forms of Kabbalistic magic, that the Psalms are used as their own incantations, as their own invocations. And they already are very powerful petitions to God. The majority of them are, "Lord, please cast down my enemies," but but nonetheless, they are believed to have their own power. But when you're doing things and reciting these long prayers and reciting these different incantations and stuff like that in the grimoires, you know, a lot of occultists would say you should memorize that in advance because a spirit will never take you seriously if they show up and find you flipping through a book.
Fascinating. I look at it and I think about things like the memorization changes the psyche. So I always go back to things like that.
In a way, it does. I think Kevin Townley here in Colorado, I think he puts it best. He says, when you've memorized the ritual, you've internalized it. You have embodied it. It's now a part of you.
Yeah.
If you're just spewing out the words, it's not the same as having memorized it. When you've truly memorized it, it's become a part of you. And when you have truly memorized the work and have internalized it, you yourself become a living symbol of the craft. And I always love the way he put that.
Yeah, Kevin's a good friend. He tell people when they meet Kevin for the first time, he's a real deal guy. You're either going to love it or you're going to be like, wow, that's an esoteric guy and I don't know. But I think Kevin does a great job of identifying with just about most people I've ever seen him interact with. People tend to just like the guy. He's incredible.
Well, one thing I like about him is that he tries to understand the craft through the craft. He's not often these other weird places.
Yep.
And looking weird things. Like, you know, me, you know, I don't understand alchemy. I've researched it a lot, and same thing with Kabbalah, and I don't seem to get it, but the grimoires make sense to me, which is why I like reading and studying them. They make a lot of sense to me. I'm not sitting there scratching my head going, I have no idea what that means.
Yeah.
Where, like, Kevin really tries to focus on what is said in masonry, what is in the ritual, what is being done. And he tries to understand it through the craft. And then, you know, sometimes he moves off into some Kabbalistic stuff here or there, but in general, he tries to keep his understanding of the craft through masonry itself, which I really have to admire and appreciate.
Yeah, of course.
As esoteric and as out there as he gets, it's still the esoteric and out there of masonry and not going too far abroad.
Yeah, masonry in light of masonry. We've talked a lot about a lot of these topics and Western magic occult systems and the grimoires. And, you know, I alluded to at the beginning of the program that you're a pretty busy guy. I mean, you were the worshipful master of a ghost town lodge, but also you work and you do a lot of writing for the Colorado. Well, I shouldn't call it the Colorado Masons Magazine because it's not like officially the Grand Lodge magazine, but it might as well be. I mean, it's
yeah. Some people don't seem to understand that they don't like something we wrote, and then they want to report it to the Grand Lodge, and it's just like
sorry, independent publication.
Definitely get a slap on the wrist, but you know they don't own the magazine. So
right. So the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine is by far, I would say, the largest publication in terms of content. You guys have an incredible content. Your layouts are great. The articles are good. But having you on the program, you know, episode 406 and now again today, and we've heard about some of the stuff you were working on. You were working on some poetry in episode 406. You were going through that. Can you give us some updates on some of your projects?
Well, the Greenleaf stuff is still moving along. He was the guy I ranted about the last time. For the, you know, Grandmaster, Masons of Colorado, Pioneer Poet. My research on that's starting to wrap up. I have a few little holes I need to, you know, kind of finish up dealing with. It largely deals with Greenleaf in Boston.
Okay.
I'm trying to get a hold of someone from the Grand Lodge to help me out with that.
Oh, I'm going to put you in contact with somebody.
Oh, I'd appreciate that because I've reached out to so many different people and I don't hear anything. because Greenleaf was such a good friend with Bromwell. I've been digging a bit into Bromwell, and I've been finding a lot of stuff he wrote. I found that he wrote a whole series of books of poetry. Some of them only, like, they were published posthumously by his daughter. And some of them, they were only, like, 25 copies ever published. And I can't find hard copies of those, but I did find one. It was Song of the Wabi, which is, it's almost like Native American spiritualism, but still kind of wrapped up in, like, mystery rites and some Western esoteric ideas and spiritual ideas. And
fascinating.
And then looking into, like, a lot of his other Masonic writings, you know, most people, the most they get their hands on with Bromwell's writings was Restorations of Masonic Geometry.
Yep.
But I've been digging through old Square and Compass magazines, and he published a lot more than just that.
Yeah, I find it fascinating looking through the Square and Compass magazines are incredible. Thank you, by the way, for sending me the rest of the Skull articles. We're going to be putting those on the show. But those magazines are a wealth. And, you know, what was so interesting is they weren't so myopic as a lot of the other publications that were coming out through, you know, whether that was, you know, Illinois had one called Enlightenment, which was, you know, so many of these are still like charity-based or whatever, relief-based. But some of the, like Square and Compasses, always seem to have some great content in terms of symbolism, history, what have you.
They were all over the place. And not just like a variety of content. It's like a variety of authors. I mean, Greenleaf knew everybody. And so he'd get writings from authors from all over the world. So here it is, this little Colorado magazine that's meant to be for Colorado Masons, and yet, you know, it was being distributed everywhere and getting writers from all over the place. So it really is a wealth of stuff in the Square and Compass.
You work quite a bit with the Colorado Lodge of Research as well. You're working on a set of papers, like a whole volume. Are you guys republishing?
Yeah, so we have a whole series of papers, and they used to just be distributed. They'd pretty much be photocopied and then hole-punched and stuck in a binder, and that was how they were distributed. And that kind of stopped sometime in, like, the 80s, maybe early 90s. Anyway, so we have, God, I want to say about a little over 70 years worth of papers.
Oh, wow.
And last year, the Worshipful Master Marty Sugg decided he was going to make use of a committee that our bylaws allow us to have, but had never been filled. and he put me and Ben in charge of going through the old past papers, getting them digitized, and getting them ready for publication. So we put out Volume 1 back in March. You can find that on Research Lodge of Colorado's website. You can find that on laughinglion.net. And it's done through Lulu. And now, since we're in quarantine, I have a lot more free time on my hands. So I've already gone through and read all the papers for Volume 2, and I'm about halfway through putting them into layout. And so hopefully by summer we'll have that one ready for publication.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I'll make sure I have some links back to Volume 1 for everybody, as well as Rocky Mountain Mason. So, Patrick, I just want to say thank you so much for taking some time on a Sunday night to come on and talk to us about Western mysteries and grimoires. And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there now who are going to be looking to pick up a few copies of some of these old texts and really kind of dig into them. Before I let you go, if you could say what your favorite grimoire is, and if you were going to recommend one to somebody who is curious, which one would you recommend?
Maybe it's not quite a grimoire, but I definitely use it because I like it. I get maybe it is a grimoire, but it's called The Power of Psalms, and it's by Anna Reba. It's the voodoo use of the Psalms. So it's not like our cliche idea of voodoo like we see in like American Horror Story or something. But it does go through all the different Psalms and illustrate, you know, that you can recite these and use these for different purposes. So, you know, if you're in need of money, or if you're just in need of greater strength within yourself, you know, you can look through the list and go, okay, this psalm seems to be appropriate, or this part of it, and she'll give you instructions of what to do. I find the Psalms to just be incredibly powerful, and I think it's really intriguing that Psalm 133 is used in voodoo to strengthen existing friendships and make new friends. And I think that gives a whole different power to our use of Psalms 133 in masonry. That would be one that I definitely recommend. Anybody who wants to try this sort of stuff and use it for good, beneficent purposes, I really like Anna Reba's book. If you're just really curious about a grimoire, what are they? You know, the classic one to pick up is Key of Solomon. Mather's translation is completely sufficient. Dr. Stephen Skinner translated four other versions called The Veritable Key of Solomon. It's pretty good. If you were to ask me what is truly like my favorite old grimoire, I'd probably say The Arvatel. It gives a good philosophy of magic, and that magic is meant to be used for the good of, like, your neighbor, your community, and that it should be used for selfless purposes, that you should approach it as, you know, Jesus would. You know, Jesus went out and healed people. He didn't ask for money or anything like that. And he then tell the people, I've done this for you, just keep it between you and me. Arvatel seems to emulate that in many ways. Joseph H. Peterson did a great translation on that. And it gives the Latin as well as the English translation.
That's the one I have. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It is.
So probably another good grimoire is Heptameron. That's also a very Christian-style grimoire. And you can find that its entirety is published in the fourth book of occult philosophy, which... If people say it's not written by Agrippa, he did write the first book, and then it's quite clear the other books are other texts that they just stuck in there. One of them they stick in there is the Heptameron, as well as the Arvatel. So that's kind of my recommendations if you're just curious at looking at these.
Yeah, I love it. So what we'll do also, in addition, is we'll flag those books and we'll put links back to them. Just Amazon cart stuff if we can find them. Patrick, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. This was awesome.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.